I'd like to try to help piece together what we're doing on Sunday nights by at least repeating the topics we've been looking at for the last few weeks and saying they are related to what we're going to do tonight. We talked about the two ways Jesus sets before the human being, a broad way and a narrow way. Two foundations, one on sand, one on rock. And notably, while it's awfully tempting to decide we aren't going to be here too long, and the best thing is to build a pretty house and not worry about digging too deeply, when crisis comes, everything depends on the foundation, and the house is no better than the foundation. And we talked about the fact that when one chooses a way, a road, one end of a road, he chooses automatically the other end of the road because the road leads somewhere. Two ways through life and the challenge he places from this. We talked then about the right, the good, and the happy. The search a person makes in life for the thing that's best for him to do. And we looked especially at the rich young ruler with a gaping hole in his life because even though he'd kept the commandments, he had not really stacked his priorities correctly. God was not first, and he hadn't found the fulfillment he was seeking. Then we talked about final ground, the fact that we're on final ground, that as a world of people we may well have had our last chance at war, that we must find a way to live together, to live before God, and what we're looking for is final ground upon which to live that life. And then we talked about authority last Sunday night. Our respect for authority because it helps to provide us with that final ground, authority in the home, the church, the government. Tonight we're raising a new question, but it's related to all of those, and it has to do with the personality of God. I really think that atheism is not a very attractive alternative for most of us. I don't know what it's like to grow up in a country where everybody is supposed to be atheistic. Maybe it is an attractive alternative for such people, if they've never known anything else. But for people who've known something about God, it isn't an attractive alternative. It raises a lot more problems than it even seems to solve. But what is attractive to us at times is to think of God not as personal being, but as a great force behind the universe, the great first cause, the great designer, the watchmaker, the one who is the élan vital, the life force of the world and the human race. But we've lost the conception of him being our friend and our father. It's difficult for us to think of him as knowing our lives and having a plan for each of us, an interest in us. It's easy to think of some great power behind the universe, but difficult to think that he knows me and has an interest in my life. I think there are lots of reasons for that. One is that when a person mills through a large city, and we live in one, he's impressed with the numbers of people, and he wonders how anyone could have all these people at heart. When one looks up into the vast heavens and sees the far-flung stars, it's difficult for him to see how anyone who put all that in motion could be interested in a small person like you or myself. The world of science, with which we've become so familiar, is a world of abstractions, a world which looks for general laws that rule. And while it's attractive to set up a great first law or force behind the laws, it's difficult to think that the one who governs all that law could be interested in us. There are a lot of results that flow out of this problem. It's acute in the 20th century, but not peculiar to our century. But among the results is that we are a people who are afraid. I've mentioned this before as we've talked about this same series of thoughts, building blocks for life. But I think we are a people afraid. Dr. Harold Urey, a Nobel Prize winner, not the Peace Prize, but another, has written, "I am writing to you as to make you afraid. I'm writing as a man who is afraid. All of the wise men I know are afraid." He was one of the developers of the atom bomb, and it was in that context that he was writing of his fear. Dr. Joseph Gander has said that every age has its own particular malady, and ours is neurosis. Any doctor will tell you that at least half his patients suffer from it. Or Dr. Alphonse Nader has commented that the people he knows who are most concerned to state their disbelief are the very people who are most obsessed with the problems that he would call religious problems. And over, the statements could be multiplied. Those are taken from Paul Turnier's study, The Whole Person in a Broken World. But they've been put together from live sources where men were pouring out their own assessment of the world we live in and our incapacity to deal with it as we think we ought. We need, if ever a people needed, an attachment to the personal God. I think there's some justification for the revulsion of modern man away from this personal God. There's no question that we grow up with childhood conceptions of God that are inadequate, and we mature in every other field but do not mature in many instances in our religious knowledge, and try to carry over that childhood conception into adulthood, and it doesn't really satisfy the mind, so we turn away in unbelief. A child is apt to think of God as being a human being, but a very large one, a very old one. Back in the Death of God controversy of the late 60s, Time magazine interviewed a sampling of people around the globe. They talked to a person in Tel Aviv who said, "I think of God as an old man with a long gray beard sitting in a white chair." And when one carries that kind of conception through life with him, it's difficult to keep believing in that person, that being. J.B. Phillips in Your God is Too Small has listed 10 or 12 ways men think of God. They conceive of him as a kind of great-grandfather who is very lenient with his creatures and wants the best for us, or a bellhop that we can call anytime we're in need of a fire escape, or perhaps a resident policeman who serves as an inside conscience to call us down when we're going the wrong direction. But Phillips emerges from all those inadequate conceptions with an appeal to see God in the face of Jesus Christ, the best of possible places to look at God. Way back before Socrates and Plato in the 5th and 4th centuries B.C., Xenophanes, a Greek philosopher, commented that the Ethiopians make their gods with black hair and flat noses. The Thracians make theirs with red hair and blue eyes. It was his way of saying what many a cynic has said: God created man in his own image, and man promptly returned the compliment. But it's a fact that we have so often thought of God as being like ourselves, so much like ourselves, that we found ourselves incapable of believing in him. Phillips pictures us as seeing God as a busy switchboard operator. We just couldn't plug in and hear all of those prayers. But that's so inadequate. Isaiah was getting at this when he said, "My ways are not your ways, neither are my thoughts your thoughts, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Chapter 55. Now, I can't tell you everything about God, all of what he was like, but I can tell you that it helps when one begins to get rid of the inadequate conception, leave a little mystery in his understanding of God, but still think of him in terms of biblical revelation. There's a word, anthropomorphism, which means that we think of God as being like man. Anthropos, man, morphe, form, making God in the form of man, or talking about God as if he were a man. There are at least two kinds of this that have characterized religious history. There's a very simple kind of speaking of God as if he were a man. The ancient Greeks, again with their paganism, thought of the gods living out on Mount Olympus. I've stood along the Areopagus and then by the Parthenon and looked out at Mount Olympus. It's a beautiful sight. But I wondered how anybody could ever believe the gods lived out there. Why not just go out and see? But the Greeks thought their gods were there when they weren't out lusting and drinking and fighting and reveling in a way that human beings could hardly do. It was their own anthropomorphic way of thinking of the gods as being very much like human beings, even worse in the extent of their wrongdoing. a simple way of thinking of God as being like a man. Now, the Bible has a simple way of thinking of God as being like man. You find it in Genesis especially, when the voice of the Lord God walks in the garden in the cool of the day. When he says to Adam, "Where are you?" You find it when God closes the door of the ark, shuts Noah and his family in. Here's a way of thinking of God as being like men. His ear is inclined to hear men's prayers. But how are men going to speak of God unless they do it in human ways? How are we going to picture him unless we do it with his having the functions of human personality? But there is a mature form of thinking of God as being like man where the highest characteristics of man are attributed to him. Plato and Socrates themselves rejected all those claimed gods out on Mount Olympus. What they did say was that the God or gods behind the universe really have personality and knowledge and will and purpose. In fact, they said only God has those characteristics perfectly. Man has them imperfectly. And you have something of that in the Bible. But you have it from Revelation, and you have it more perfectly. And you have in Amos and Hosea and Isaiah and Jeremiah a picture of God who is a God of mercy and love and justice and will. One who purposes and plans, and who has his way of bringing about those plans to their fruition. So there is a way of thinking of God as being like men without saying that God has our frailties. Our personalities have defects. We're in the process of being developed. God's personality is without defect. He's perfect. He doesn't need the development. But there's no better way to speak of God than in terms of the highest we know. And that's the way Jesus did it. And that's the clincher. In Luke 11, a little later than this occasion when he taught the disciples to pray, "Our Father who art in heaven," he said, verses 13 and 14, "If you being evil know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give the Holy Spirit to them who ask him?" In Matthew's account, it's how much more will he give good gifts to those who ask him. The how much more is important. God is likened to man, but he's so much greater than we are. He doesn't have our frailties, our weaknesses. We have to think of God in personal terms. These are the only terms we have. He's far greater than human personality, but we mean simply that he's a center of consciousness and purpose and will and power and love. And he has all of those characteristics in perfection. Now there are special needs for that understanding of God in all of our lives. Eastern philosophy and religion has always been a bit mystical and pantheistic. I'm talking about Indian philosophy, for example, Hinduism, Buddhism. Shankara, famous Indian philosopher, talked of God in very impersonal terms, the great absolute. But there's a story out of his life that I think helps illustrate my point. When Shankara's mother was near death, she called him to her bedside and said, "I can't relate to your absolute. I can't think him. I can't see him. I can't know him." And Shankara, to help his mother across the valley of the shadow of death, guess what he did? Sat down and wrote a hymn to the deity in personal terms so she could sing it and feel close to him. There is within man that need, and the reasons are clear. The Bible insists in the first place that God created us as persons, and that indicates his own personal nature. He created persons and placed them in the world for relationship with himself. We shouldn't think of him as being inferior to ourselves. He's certainly superior. How much more, as Jesus put it, that he created the kind of people that he described as being in his image. But that doesn't mean that he has a body of flesh and bones as we have, as the Book of Mormon has erroneously understood it to mean. It means rather that we're made in the likeness of God as spirit. That we're made in the likeness of his being as mind and intelligence, who has purpose and will, knowledge and love. We're in his image. He created us for fellowship with himself. Catherine Mansfield was an atheist. She left a collection of letters. And in those letters she wrote of her home down in the south of France, where she would describe herself as waking in the morning, seeing that beautiful sea and all those beautiful stones and flowers and trees. And she said, "Oh, if there were only someone to thank." And I think that impulse she had to speak her gratitude to someone was far more true than any argument she ever heard against the existence of God. Inside her, a person made in God's image, there was a longing to thank someone for the beauties of life. In the Old Testament, God says to Israel again and again, "I'll be your God, and you'll be my people." In Deuteronomy 7, verses 6 through 8, he says, "It wasn't because you were the largest nation, or the richest, or the greatest that I chose you for fellowship with me. It's because I loved you." God chose Israel and invited them into fellowship with himself because they were the special object of his love, and they were the instrument through which he would bring salvation to others. He made us for relationship. He made us to be grateful to him. But it isn't just the experience of gratitude that a person senses. Haven't you had the feeling when there was no other human being present that you were just sorry for the kind of person you'd become? That you just wish you could tell someone how sorry you were that you hadn't lived up to the standard you knew you ought to be reaching? That's a good impulse. Because you're made in God's image, you want to express your gratitude to him and you want to tell him you're sorry. He's personal. He created persons. He's personal. He revealed himself as a person. Jesus said to his apostles the night before his death, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." Philip had just said, "Lord, show us the Father and it will be enough." And Jesus said, "Have I been so long time with you, Philip, and you don't know who I am? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." God revealed himself in a person. "The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." No man has seen God at any time. But the only begotten of the Father is in the bosom of the Father. He has made him known. That's John 1. He has told us what he's like because the personal Creator revealed himself in a person. That's why Jesus taught us, "Pray, Our Father, who art in heaven." There's a directness about it. No ifs or buts or reservations. Just call him Father. He insisted that we can approach God as Father, and that has just a depth of meaning in it. For one thing, it means that he's interested in all his children's cares. Look at him in that boat going across the Lake of Galilee. He knows that the Father is interested in him. He lived that way. He didn't just teach it. He lay there asleep with his head on a pillow. The disciples came to awaken him. They were quite excited. Bunch of fishermen. They knew that sea and they knew that whirlwind was dangerous. But Jesus knew, in the words of Isaiah that, and of Deuteronomy, that the Lord could bear us up with wings like the eagle, and that underneath are the everlasting arms. That he can save from the storm. That his arms were giving the protection. Jesus lived by it. He didn't just teach it. The fact that God is Father means that he knows every one of us, that he loves us. You know, the size of your child doesn't have the faintest bearing on the amount of love you have for that child, if you have one. You love him just as much when he's 18 inches long and weighs 7 pounds as you ever could when he's 6'4" and a 250-pound tackle. Just doesn't make any difference. The size doesn't affect it. God knows us and loves every one of us. A father doesn't love his family in general. He loves each child. Each one. That's what the Father image of God is getting across to us. He knows us. He loves us. That gives a whole different view. And you see it again all through the life of Jesus. There's a big crowd, I'm sure, around that pool of Bethesda. Must have been a score of people or more. It's a special time in Jerusalem. Jesus went right through them all to that one man who'd been ill 38 years and healed him. There was a crowd over Nain that day in Luke 7, but Jesus went straight to that widow and raised her son. People were thronging around him, gaping crowds again. When he picked out one woman who'd had a flow of blood 12 years and made her well, he knew each person, knew their needs, and cared. That's what God is like. Can we think of God as personal? I don't think you can think of him any other way. You just can't pray to Alfred North Whitehead's principle of concretion. That may be fine for a philosopher, but it doesn't make much sense in prayer. One can call him, with Henry Nelson Wyman, the integrating force of our personality, but that doesn't do much for the prayer life, or for worship, or for the relationship. That's why Jesus called him Father, because that's what he is, what he's really like. Oh, I know that we don't understand everything we'd like to know about him, that our descriptions of him are going to be inadequate. They have to be, because of the limitations of human language. C.S. Lewis once commented that God is different from our conception of him, not as black is different from white. It's not totally opposite. But like a child's first struggle at drawing a wheel is different from a perfect circle. And I think that's pretty well true. If it's foolish to think of God being exactly like a man, it's foolish to think of him being totally different or other than the creatures he's created in his own image. If we could somehow be aware of his presence, his personal care for us, the fact that he is Father, that he not only so loved the world, every sinner who repents brings joy to his heart. We have a different view of sin and forgiveness. Sin is not a crime against impersonal law somewhere out there in the universe. Sin is a crime against love, because it was the Father who loved us and gave us the life that we've abused. Many of you have seen either the play or the movie Mary Chases Harvey. Elwood P. Dowd was a fellow who had a very close friend who was an enormous rabbit. And it was embarrassing to the whole family, because Elwood was always making room for that rabbit to sit at the table or go through an entry. Or wherever he was, there had to be room for Harvey. So the family hired Dr. Chumley. And it was the psychiatrist's business to relieve Elwood of that mirage. And he worked with him, but he tried to keep an open mind like a good doctor. And eventually he began to see a little bit of that unseen rabbit. And he said, "Fly specks. Fly specks, all my life I've worked with when there were miracles down at 18th and Fairfax." That's where Elwood had met Harvey. And finally, after a little bit more conversation between Dr. Chumley and Elwood, he burst out, "I've got to have that rabbit." It just strikes me that if we could have the kind of relationship with God, the kind of awareness of his presence that Elwood had of his friend, that that's probably the depth of meaning the writer was trying to get across in the play to begin with. And it would be a wonderful thing if other people could look at us and see through our faith in the living God something strong enough to say, "I've got to have him as my Father." You may, by doing his will, responding to his love while we sing.
Streams of mercy never ceasing, call the songs of honest praise. Teach me of glory, may I still my goodness prove, while the Lord in his glory fills my heart. Here I lay my Ebenezer.
Be seated, please. I'd like to introduce tonight Elijah and Susan Turman. They formerly worshiped with the Wooddale congregation in the city. Elijah is a teacher at Memphis State University in the Department of Health, Physical Education, and Recreation, and Susan is a housewife. They have a daughter, Rachel, 19 months old, and live at 3421 Prescott Circle. Lige and Susan Turman. Would you stand, please? Over here. Thank you. I don't think I told the people here this morning. If I did, the photographer was gone, but Brother McKenzie has a studio back at the rear of the auditorium here with a Polaroid, and he'd like to get a picture of you tonight after service for the bulletin so people can recognize you more readily and also for the directory. I failed to introduce a student at the graduate school who was placing membership with us this morning. His card just stuck in the side of the pocket, and he isn't here tonight. He's out preaching. But his name is Paul Isom, and he'll be introduced at the Sunday morning service next week, and it was my oversight. The elders have asked me to announce that 2 weeks from today, October 12, at 2 p.m., it's the day for the regular elders, deacons, and preachers meeting. There will be a meeting extended beyond elders, preachers, and deacons to all other men of the congregation. The purpose of the hour-long meeting will be to rehearse with you some of the accomplishments of the congregation during this year and to discuss with you and have suggestions from you the kind of work we need to be doing in 1976. An hour-long planning, thinking, reporting session we hope you'll make special effort to be present for. All men of the congregation, October 12, 2 weeks from today, at 2 p.m.
It's good to have you at Highland Street tonight, and I know that after you've heard these two excellent lessons today, that your life just has to be blessed. And Harold, I want to thank you in a very personal way for the two excellent lessons today that really blessed my life, and I know that it has everyone that is here, and how he keeps coming up and challenging us and so forth is just, it's just a God-given ability that Harold uses, and we just are very, very grateful that he's a part of our team here. As I call him, he's our head-talking preacher, and that's his role, and that's what he does in the most excellent way. Wayman returned with a number of young people this afternoon from a retreat, and Wayman says that 27 recommitted youth and sponsors returned from Camp Pinecrest this afternoon. One young lady from the Park Avenue Church was baptized. All of the participants were challenged to become better servants as they studied the theme, Are You in the Arena? So we're glad to have the young people back after this excellent retreat this week. Also, the Tuesday night share group will continue studying in the book of Philippians at the Henson's apartment from 7 until 8 this week. I want to mention something that we mention quite often here, but something that needs to be underlined continually. We have four missionary families that are scattered around the world, literally, that are directly sponsored by Highland Street here. We ask you occasionally if you would take the time to write them. I try to mention this about once a month just because I feel like it's good for us. And that's what I want to do tonight. If you would take the time this week to write at least one of these families, telling them that you're thinking of them, praying for them, just showing them that you have a genuine care for them. This means so very much, as they are not a part of the encouraging fellowship like we are, but they're out there on the leading edge of the kingdom where they don't have as many people to relate to as you and I do. So let's remember them this week. The Lord's Supper is prepared in the fellowship hall for those that didn't have an opportunity of communion this morning. If you would rise at this time and go to the fellowship hall, you'll be served.